For many years in our society, there's been an obsession with being young, acting young, thinking young. I guess I'm a throwback, because to me, one of the most valuable things an older person like me can offer to younger people is maturity. I don't want to prove to anybody that I am a young man or that I act like a young man. I want to prove, or I want to say, that when someone reaches my age and has spent a lot of years doing a lot of things, that he can explain what he has learned from those years and those experiences. As I say, this is a very old-fashioned idea. It used to be taken for granted that a young person got his or her concept of who they were. That is to say, what people they belonged to, what their personal identity was, and their general approach to life from sitting on the porch and listening to the older people talk. That used to be taken for granted. I have a feeling that the present idea, or the present idea that everybody, all us old folks, should try to be young, comes from the like so many problems, comes from the group that calls itself the Greatest Generation. Now, the Greatest Generation said that they had already done their part by the end of World War II, and the world owed them endless gratitude and praise, decade after decade, and an endless flow of government benefits, all because of what they did before they were 30, and many of them before they were 20. The group that calls itself the Greatest Generation has, or rather, did not want to grow up. They wanted to be the same young men who fought the war, and they wanted to prove they were still young. And in the 1960s, I remember the hippies, the World War II generation announcers, would talk about how they were still just like the young people. These young people were young radicals, and they were young radicals. Now, the reason a person tries to convince young people or that he is one of them is not to prove something to them. It's to prove something to himself. He does not want to admit that he really doesn't know much that young people need to know. About 50% of the World War II veterans took advantage of the GI Bill of Rights and went to college. So what they have to tell young people is A, what they learned in the military, which was to be as obedient as a good dog, and to repeat what the professors had told them afterward. As I say, one of the tragedies of history is that what I call the weakest generation, the group that calls itself the Greatest Generation, was put through basic training, which was designed specifically to beat every trace of human dignity out of a man and to make him what they call dog faces, as obedient as a dog. Then they went to college and they learned from the professors what we call leftism, which is the idea that professors should rule the world. Intellectuals like Marx, who never did a day's work in his life, or like their professor, who never did a day's work in his life, that these intellectuals should rule the world. Now, the problem with this is that here we have a guy who was in his 20s when he left the army, left his obedience training. Then he spent 4 or 5 years learning that professors should rule the world. And he's talking to young people who are being trained in exactly the same thing. They're being trained in college, in their education, or it starts in high school. Their teachers are teaching them that intellectuals should rule the world. So the net result is that the greatest generation doesn't have any wisdom to pass on. They're stuck. And they see themselves as not as mature people, but as the young idealist and the young soldier who fought World War II. So all of them wanted, or not all of them, but we became obsessed with this youth is everything idea. When I turned 40, I was on Capitol Hill, and the head of staff for the Education and Labor Committee, where I was working, was a good buddy of mine. And he sat me down and he said, "Bob, you've just turned 40. And let me tell you something." He said, "Everybody respects you as a fighter. And I don't want you to stop being a fighter. But there's one thing you really have to learn, and that is everybody has a lot of tolerance for an angry young man. Young people are supposed to be brash. They're supposed to be to say things that older people would not say. They're supposed to be moody. Better if they're not, but that's part of youth. But," he said, "nobody has any use for an angry middle-aged man or for an angry old man." Now that, I always treasure good advice, and that was excellent advice. I tried to temper my actions. I tried to remember that I was now a 40-year-old man, not a young radical. And it helped me a great deal. And it explained to me some of the things that I was doing wrong. Someone here at the condominiums where I live made me a great compliment one time. He said, "You know, every time you show up, everybody ends up laughing. Everybody ends up happy." Well, of course, that's unfortunately not perfectly true, but it was quite a compliment. Now, in dealing with young people, if I get on the elevator with a young person, I find an excuse to say something like, "Well, you young guys have it easy. When I was young, I used to walk 40 miles in the snow to school." And they always have heard that one before. After all, the World War II generation is still around. And they finish it up with, "Uphill all the way, right? Uphill both ways, right? Or against the wind both ways, right?" And what we're doing is laughing at this comment that we're all very tired of hearing about how the older guys in World War II had it tough and everybody else had it easy and we owe them this and we owe them that and so forth. It's become a joke. But also, I'm making it very clear to this younger person that I'm not like him. I'm not a young person. And I think that's a bit of a relief to them. I don't know exactly how you can measure whether I get along with younger people better than other people my age. But when I was in alcohol and drug recovery for a substantial period of time, the number of young people who wanted me for their sponsor was a lot more than I could handle. And I think it was partly because I was not trying to be with it. I was not trying to be one of them. I was just trying to use the fact that I am mature, and that was what they were looking for from me. To put it very simply, a young person is surrounded by young people. He really doesn't need one more older buddy with gray hair. If he needs anything from me, it is from the fact that I was young once. I remember it vividly, and I am now where they will be someday. So I can give them some advice. Lord knows I don't want them to be another Bob Whitaker. But what I can tell them is some of the stuff I have learned, some of the things I've done wrong. Maturity, in other words, is a good thing. It is a gift, and one should share it very carefully with younger people. Back in the 60s, when all of those middle-aged announcers from the World War II generation were trying to convince everybody that they were young too, just like these hippies, they were still the young radicals that they'd always been, my reaction was, that's kind of pathetic. So a grown man trying to say that he is still young and that he can play hopscotch better than the kids can, and he's with it. There's a certain amount of that, I think, that goes into this obsession we have with the latest news. People always seem to think that the future depends on the latest news. It's sort of a warped idea that if you want to look to the future, you ought to look to the latest thing, because after all, that's the nearest thing to the future. But the way I was raised down here in the deep and benighted South was that if you want to know the future, you should know who you are. You should know what other people have been through. If you want to study what will happen in the next decades, then what you have to do is look at the earlier decades, not at the news headlines. And oddly enough, I made a very good living off of this little piece of wisdom. I was in hardball politics, and I'm comfortably retired on the money people paid me for doing that, so I must be reasonably good at it. But I looked down through the decades while other people were obsessed with whatever was in the Washington Post the day before. I was predicting what would happen from what I had seen and, frankly, what I had heard from older people when I was young. Because human beings just don't change that much. A lot of things change in this world, but people are pretty much the same historically. And if you want to know what's going to happen next, what you have to do first is understand the movement, the history, And that doesn't mean the history of last week's New York Times. That means a very long view of things. One of the big differences I have realized only recently between my thinking and that of a lot of people in politics and in any movement, including ours, is that many, many people talk in terms of, are we winning or are we losing? The idea being that there will be a day on which we will win or we will lose. What I think in terms of is politics. That's what I talk about. What they are talking about is religion. You see, the Christian religion says that the final decisions will come on Judgment Day. Islam says the same thing. Communism says that the world will end when the whole world is truly communist and everybody is as peaceful and as equal as a bunch of castrated steers, as a herd of castrated steers. And, of course, Judaism seems to feel that the world will end, the final goal will be reached, and they will win when everybody feels guilty and sorry for the Jews and gives them lots and lots of money, and the Jews can then dedicate their entire time to feeling sorry for themselves. Now, Christianity, Islam, communism, and Judaism are religions. Hinduism and Buddhism are also religions, and they believe the world will end when, and the final victory achieved, when people are freed from the wheel of life, and at that point, some people say nirvana, but actually they want to be off of the wheel of life, a constant, this transmigration of souls that we consider a religious doctrine. Not exactly that. In Hinduism and Buddhism, the continual rebirth is a curse, not a blessing. I remember reading a quote from Buddha where he was talking about a bad kind of thinking, and he said it leads to rebirth. And to a Christian, of course, the idea of being born again is the ultimate blessing. And so this whole thing has been sort of translated into our terms so that there's this kind of paradise where everybody goes to nirvana. But the basic religion of Hinduism and Buddhism, Hinduism is sort of the Old Testament to Buddhism, their idea was that finally this chain of being reborn again and again and again would end. So religions think in terms of a beginning and an end. We're talking about politics. Politics does not have an end. This whole idea that we're going to win or lose really doesn't have much to do with true worldly politics. I look down the ages, what my grandfather told me, what his grandfather told him, and I see that politics, or reality, in the sense that I am talking about, doesn't have this alpha and omega, the beginning and the end. I'm not exactly sure when the alpha of politics was. Certainly, there was politics when the first animal, the first herd animal, developed. One of the herd wanted to be the top dog. I even have a little nagging suspicion that millions of years before that, when all the animals were one-celled, that some one-celled animal wanted to be the top one-celled animal in his particular slime pool. But I can't tell you when the alpha of politics was, but I can tell you when the omega of politics, the end of politics, is, and that is never. For example, we talk about the white race. The Jews constitute about one in 500 of the people of the world, about 12 million. The Jews are very much around, very much an identity, and it will be a little while before we reach down to 12 million. White people. The fight goes on, and if the whole world, or if our society were all white, there would be politics. A lot of the people I'm allied with would be arguing with me and about the size of government and all these other things. There simply is no end. There is no we will win or we will lose. This fight goes on forever. And that has been a crippling problem. Not realizing that has been a crippling problem for a lot of our people, because they're always whining about who's going to win and who's going to lose. We're going to have to take, those of us who are worried about the white race are going to have white people around for an awfully long time to come. In fact, the decision about having children is very soon going to be a decision about whether what children you want, designer genes, are simply going to come. No matter how many people scream that it's a problem or it's evil or it's Hitlerism or anything else, the fact is people are going to be able to decide what kind of children they're going to have, and the ones who don't are going to be pretty irrelevant, because they're going to be having normal intelligence children who can't compete in the real world. One thing that's absolutely shocking to people is a possibility that I have mentioned that is just like so many predictions I have made in my lifetime that sounded absolutely nuts at the time I made them, and I was dead right. I have quite a reputation, but as I say, I did make a pretty good living on this sort of thing. The day may come when India is white and we are brown. The reason for that is that India has a knowledge that its upper classes were Aryans, real blonde Aryans. In fact, Gautama Buddha, who founded the Buddhist religion, is well known, and this is from Oriental sources, to have had eyes the color of a lotus. And for those of you who don't know it, a lotus is very, very blue. The old TV series Kung Fu talked about this method of fighting that was supposed to be part of ancient Chinese culture. Actually, the man who brought Kung Fu to China also has another legend about him. It was said that he actually cut a hole in a wall with the stare of his blue eyes. Now, there was an ad on Indian television not too long ago about an Indian girl who wanted to marry a Dutchman. And in order to do that, she took the advertised product, which made her look whiter. Now, that ad would be banned anywhere else. But in India, the legacy of the Aryans is still very much revered, and the Indians have not learned to crawl into the corner and wet their diapers and feel guilty the way we have. Genuine Aryan children, not just light children, genuine Aryan children, will be the choice of several million Indians. And odd as that sounds odd today because India has always been known as the third world country. But they don't have these inhibitions. Everybody here is now saying that it's evil and Nazi for someone to object to parents in the Appalachians, white parents adopting Chinese or other non-white children. But that little thing works two ways. You can't then turn around and say, well, no Indian would want a white child as one of his own. Well, all you would do is take out the genes that were not upper caste Aryan genes. And believe me, it's going to be done. And in fact, the guarantee is going to be made when the time comes that these are Aryan children, not just Indian children, mixed blood Indian children painted white. The lower caste genes will have been taken out. The caste system, by the way, has an Indian name from Sanskrit called Naryu. The word Naryu means color. So while India has plenty of grudges against white people, it has a definite prejudice. That is to say, many millions of Indians have a definite preference for the Aryans who founded the present Indian civilization, Hinduism, all the rest. And as I say, making the Indians feel guilty about this is going to be one hell of a job. So there's a weird prediction from Whitaker, but if just a few million Indians decide to have Aryan children, there will still be more white children, really white children, on this planet than there are Jews. So when you ask, are we going to win or are we going to lose on Judgment Day, let's get over the idea that we are talking religion. We're talking politics. There is no Judgment Day in politics. Politics will keep going. The fights will keep going. And politics are alive and well in brown countries, white countries, you name it. Back in the days when maturity was considered a virtue, this advice I just gave, that politics has no alpha and omega, that we're not going to win and we're not going to lose. That's the kind of advice that older people routinely gave younger people. A younger person has not been alive all that long, and the present situation is his whole world. He tends to look at the world from the point of view of the latest headlines. He tends to look at whatever is going on as what will go on forever. And the older person says, no, you do your job, and things go on, which of course drives young people crazy, but that's what you have us old guys around for. The advice is that no matter what happens, I still have a fight to make for the white race, and a lot of things are going to change out of recognition. And this is something young people have extreme difficulty understanding, just how much things change. And they tend to forget that what was considered absolutely inevitable 10 years ago is laughable now. The problem is that we now have an older generation that thinks exactly the same way, that whatever is going on now is the inevitable future. Anyone who's been around a while and who is not hypnotized by this World War II thinking knows that the inevitables are going to collapse. And nobody knows what the future is going to be like. Therefore, what an older person says is, do your job, do the job that is in front of you, and keep doing it. Forget about the state of the world. You have your job as in determining the future state of the world. But whatever it is you're panicking about is not worth panicking about. You have to figure out how you can influence things. Well, that sounds exactly like the sort of advice the old guy would give that drives the young people crazy. Because, as I say, the young people are obsessed with today and with the inevitable and whether they're going to win or lose and the awful thing. They're supposed to be. Young people are supposed to be that way. They're supposed to be angry. They're supposed to be, as the fellow said to me, they're supposed to be angry young people if there's something to be angry about. But there also needs to be some of the old guys. And, of course, the younger people think, well, he's just being too calm about it. This is the way things actually are. Tell you another secret. We're not always right. The older guy is not a seat of wisdom just because he's older. What he is saying is something that the young person should listen to, but not take as gospel. I don't think that any of my listeners consider what I say as gospel, but if you're listening, you obviously think it's worth listening to, worth hearing, and that is why maturity is a virtue. It is not the virtue, it is a virtue. Some of us, despite the World War II generation, despite the hippies, some of us actually grew up during our lifetime, and we are relatively few, and I think we're worth listening to. This is Bob Whitaker, the Untrained Eye, and I look forward to talking to you next week.